Chapter 11. I fight my first duel of honour. Just when we thought that the sudden burst of warm weather we got a few weeks after Yule would take us gently into spring, Sevendor got hit with a blizzard. Under the circumstances, we were as well prepared as we could be. It helped that I had foreknowledge of the storm, thanks to my duties as the Marshal of the Penumbra. It was an official title that meant I had some oversight of the war effort, particularly the magical side, around northwestern Alshar, the area that would become known as the Mage Lands. I had decent subordinates who were doing the actual work while I took a break, became a father, and ordered my lands, but I still felt obligated to check in with them regularly. I mostly haven't mentioned such exchanges because they were mostly of the, "Yeah, it's cold here too," variety. The Gavani might be nocturnal, but they didn't like trying to fight in snow any more than did the Humani. Less so, when your fur is all black, you stand out against an all-white background well enough for an archer to find you pretty easily, even in the dark. And the Alshari are good archers. For the most part, the Gavani had kept to their cantonments in captured castles and villages in the Umbra and Penumbra, as well as the fallen towers of the North Watch. Our forces were in the castles and villages on the other side of the line, centred on the town-turned-fortress of Tudri, where my friend and colleague Sire Asterol commanded under Sir Telamon, or whatever titles they were using. There had been half a dozen skirmishes or raids during the winter, but no one was moving troops around for more than patrols. Even Bellicose Azar had rarely ventured forth from Magellan Castle due to the weather and lack of activity. Most of what the army was doing these days was observation, reconnaissance, and rescuing the trickle of refugees that still made it out of the penumbra. But I was checking in one evening, mind to mind, my mind preoccupied by the number of mouths to feed and the number of loaves with which to feed them, when Asterol mentioned the storm.
"It's been howling since noon," he mentioned in passing. "I called in the patrols and pulled in the pickets already, but if what the others, with more weather knowledge than me, are saying is true, then somehow the damn Umbra is making this one worse. I don't know if it's on purpose or a simple accident of that monstrosity, but whatever is causing it, we're anticipating as much as 3 feet of snow. Perhaps more."
3 feet? That's not completely unusual for a Wilderlands winter. Bovol Vale got a couple like that the winter I was there.
"We're hundreds of miles from Bovol," he reminded me. "Mountain snows are one thing. By the time they move this far east of the Mindens, they're usually friendly little snowstorms. This is a blizzard. High winds, ice and snow, and it's fucking cold."
That gave me a thought. "How long would you say it takes for a mountain snow to make it to Tudri?"
"Well, depends on wind speed.
Look, I'm more of a water wizard, but I'd say on average, and I'm just guessing here, it takes about half a day, maybe less, for the gods to push the clouds across the sky from there to here. This one probably took 10 hours. It's a mighty storm."
"So 10 hours to cover 100, 150 miles, I reasoned. "I'm 600 or 700 miles east of you. So we're going to have to contend with this thing in 3 days?
"Yes, you poor thing," Asterol said dryly. "Of course, by the time it gets to you, it probably won't be more than a whisper of what we're getting now."
"We couldn't handle much more than that," I told him. I hadn't wanted to get into my personal business, but Asterol was bored.
"Really? Is the aristocratic life not to your liking, mage lord?" he teased. So I told him everything. About the West Flareans, about the Bovali, about the weather and the obscene cost of being a lord, about the problems with the estate, the castle, the pregnancy, the coming flood of foot wizards, the danger the censorate still posed. Everything. I didn't know Asterol as well as some of my other war magi colleagues, but we'd been through a lot in the last year, and I found him surprisingly sympathetic.
"Well, I can ease one of your problems at least," he told me when I had quit complaining. "I'll buy every sympathy stone that your pet foot wizard can find, and pay well for them. Master Camaran and Sir Lance will want them. They've already given me orders for plenty of hard-to-find things. Sympathy stones were on the list. Now I can scratch them off, and I can have an agent with a letter of credit sent to Wilderhall, where he'll wait for the stones."
"You know, that's not a bad idea," I agreed. "So, for 2 stones, how much do you think you can pay?"
"With my budget? How about 100 ounces each?
100 silver, I said, my heart sinking. I had hoped for twice that. Astaroth laughed.
Oh, you idiot! 100 ounces of gold! Believe me, I have the money.
Is being a garrison commander that rewarding?
Not in the slightest. But Rard had the good grace to give us an open line of credit on the ducal treasury of Alshar, and he's instructed his bankers to accept any drafts I make on it, despite the fact that the ownership of the actual treasury is still in some dispute.
Oh, gods, what dispute? I thought Rard had Alshar in his pocket.
A band of barons? Is that what you call a group of barons? Anyway, a bunch of southern Alshari lords didn't like the way their duke and duchess mysteriously died, just as Rard had an army conveniently on Alshari soil. So they are seriously discussing rebelling against him, and are trying to mount a rescue effort to recapture the Alshari heir, wherever Rard stashed him. They're discussing occupying the coast and the riverlands against Castal. I could see how that could cause all sorts of problems for all sorts of people. I wondered what Mother and her minions were doing about it. That seemed their sort of thing. I was just glad I didn't have to deal with it. Gosh, I forgot how much I love ducal-level politics, I said sarcastically. It's making me not mind a belligerent warlord on my doorstep all that much.
That's the proper attitude, Min, Astaroth said philosophically.
My esteemed father always said that a lord who neglects his estates to play politics deserved neither land nor position. Of course, that doesn't stop him from playing politics or neglecting his estates. But the good news is we can pay the garrison, buy food, supplies, whatever we need, and charge the ducal treasury of Alshar with it. A 200 ounces of gold towards spell components isn't going to even raise an eyebrow. And if they work as advertised, and you can get more, I can't see a future in which we don't need plenty of sympathy stones. Useful sorts of things, from what I understand.
Indeed. Well, this has been quite helpful. Any other useful advice?
Don't let your peasants go hungry, he counseled, no matter what. Some lords use low rations to control their people, and that's all right as far as it goes. But once people start starving, they forget all about such things as class and rank and social position. If Father was ever clear on one central piece of wisdom, it was to make sure the peasants have food. I recalled my adventure in the wilderness of Alshar, after Timberwatch, in which I used that very fact to defeat a band of goblins and a couple of trolls. Hunger could be a powerful weapon, but a very hard one to control. That's going to be a problem, and soon. I've got far more peasants than I have food, and I've bought so much of the local surplus already to get us this far, that prices are high now. So don't buy local, he suggested. You're near enough to a river port. Just have an agent procure your grain from upriver and ship it to you. That would take days, weeks, I complained, just to get someone out there and then to get the grain back.
So use magic. You do know how to use magic, don't you? There are plenty of ways to work this. You aren't exactly isolated. For instance, did you know that Taran went back to Rhaemir with the censor General Hartarian to inspect the censorate installations we're going to inherit? And Mavone is already at the Citadel. Master Dunsellan returned to his estates. He doesn't have much to do. And what about Penny?
Damn it.
He was right. I thanked him and started contacting people, starting with Penny. Lady Pentandra, for those who aren't keeping up, is a friend, colleague, former lover, and presently my aid in organizing, well, all of magic in the Western Duchies. She's uniquely suited for this, because she doesn't give a damn about anything but magic and sex, and on a bad day, she can skip the magic. She's from an old Rhaemiran family of magi, and when I mean old, I mean that she's descended from at least 3 Arch-Magi, 2 from the later Magocracy, and 1 from the early Magocracy. Back in the mists of time. Now she was my coordinator, was probably the best word. Advisor, perhaps. She knew where everyone was, anyway. She was back in Rhaemir herself, helping her father and brothers prepare the Magi there for a life without the censorate, under a new king. Of course she was busy, but one good thing about being me was that I didn't have to wait for her to get around to me. She couldn't help directly, not in time, but she did tell me that Master Thinrattle former Al-Shari ducal court mage, and now itinerant high mage, was a mere 300 miles upriver from me, wintering in a cousin's Riverlands estate and practising with his witchstone. I liked Master Thinradl, perhaps even more than Master Dunsellan. He didn't affect wisdom and age the way his Castali counterpart did, and he had a much more pragmatic approach to politics and power. I contacted him mind to mind easily enough, despite my unfamiliarity with the men. It turned out he was more than happy to help me out in any way he could, and it turned out he was able to arrange to have a shipment of foodstuffs put together at a decent price. His cousin's estate had done well last summer, and there was ample surplus for purchase. Thinradl even insisted on paying for shipping the load downstream as a token of his gratitude. I started to protest. I pay for what I get. But he insisted. He had just taken 2 very lucrative commissions, it turned out, both valued in the thousands of ounces of gold, and he was feeling quite generous. A few hundred here or there didn't matter too much to him now, and he felt very much in my debt. The problem was, the shipment wouldn't arrive at the Sendaria River port for almost a week at the soonest, and the blizzard would be here long before then, and that would slow down transport even more. I did the math after I finished my order, and I felt depressed. This was going to be tight. So we did the best we could with what we had, and the foreknowledge that there was a blizzard on the way put some liveliness in our step. No one else in the Riverlands had any idea that a storm was coming, but once I announced it to my hall at mealtime, no one doubted it for a moment, even the native Sevendori. They might be suspicious of a mage lord, but weather prediction was a staple of every court mage and spellmonger. Not that they were any better at it usually than anyone else, some sea magi and wind workers aside, but if you have a wizard around, the least you should expect out of him is whether or not you should put on your heavy cloak tomorrow. It was a pleasure to watch my castellan in action after I made the announcement. Sir Kay was masterful, calling out subordinates and rattling off orders as efficiently and quickly as if he was in battle. He got work parties put together, inventoried supplies, and ordered more firewood distributed. Runners went out to inform the manors and villages, and I ordered anyone still unfortunate enough to be living in a tent to be moved into the inner bailey, where they could at least have access to the heat and kitchens of the castle through the storm. It would be tight quarters, but we'd all be warmer for the snugness. Most lords, Sir Kay pointed out quietly after he had given his first round of orders, would have let their people suffer through the storm unassisted, as they considered their duty to protect their people as purely martial. I took a broader view, and while Sir Kay clearly appreciated it, he also took care to observe my departure from the normal course of nobility when he saw it, such as going out and starting to slap spells all over the place to keep the inner bailey snug. Most lords would have just ordered their court wizard to do it. Lucky me, I was my own. But the work needed to be done. Even Alia pitched in, as huge as she was. Her squadron of harpies sat her in her chair in the main hall, and she directed the placement of emergency bedding and such for the sick and injured. I'm not sure how much actual help she was, but a lot of the common folk seemed pleased to see their very pregnant lady being so industrious and involved in their affairs. In truth, I don't think I could have stopped her. I was losing control over her as her pregnancy progressed. It was around that time that nothing in the castle or our personal quarters ever seemed clean enough for her. She had drudges scrubbing every surface she could see. The bedding had to be laundered, the few tapestry hangings had to be taken out to the courtyard and beaten free of dust. All perfectly natural, according to the matrons who surrounded her. I tried to stay out of the way. She was feeling cranky nearly every moment now, and even floating in her magnificent tub wasn't providing her much comfort. The day of her delivery was imminent. I just hoped she'd wait until after the snowstorm. Not everyone was so patient. Alia's entourage seemed to take delight in reminding me just how soon it would be. I had sent for a birth sister from Sendaria weeks before, but had no answer from the priestesses of Trigg yet. "It won't be long now, Mage Lord," they cackled meaningfully. It was probably a good thing that I had the blizzard to distract me. I spent the day out in the Vale, where I inspected Sevendor Village, Gurisham Hamlet, and the Gate Tower and Dyke, personally. It was still clear, so I didn't mind the outing,
especially if it kept me a few miles away from the castle for the day. I hadn't been out there since we'd chased off the West Flareans. Tyndall happened to have guard duty that day, his red mage light hovering over the peak of the tower, and was well involved with preparing against the storm when I arrived. He looked quite lordly for a youngster. He was dressed in hardy riding leathers, a sleek leather coat of plates, wearing the new long black woolen mantle I gave him at Yule while parading back and forth across the road, giving orders like an ancient. There was almost a score of men on duty at the dyke and gate tower at the time, 10 armed guards and nearly as many Bovoli peasants from the village site across the road, who were making a few extra coppers doing heavy lifting and tedious maintenance tasks around the dyke. I saw evidence of a makeshift butts built up against one section of the rear of the dyke, and the scarecrow target looked positively peppered. I was impressed by the combined progress he and Rondal had made in the dyke, the gate, and improving Hyre's ramshackle tower, too. Instead of a rough gap between dykes, the roadway now entered a neatly flagged threshold. It was still packed dirt on each side, but the threshold was well flagged. It was a start, with what was nearly a proper gateway. The stream had likewise been fortified, with a rough pillar of mage-melded stone begun on either side of it, with an end towards securing it properly with an iron gate or culvert. The two ends of the berm, where they faced each other across the threshold, were likewise dressed in mage-melded rocks the size of my fist. It was the beginnings of a well-dressed wall, it seemed, sturdy, solid, and easily defended. Above the gateway on either side were two well-wrought wooden blinds, roofed with thatch for now, with panels of tightly woven sticks keeping the winds at bay. It provided ample sighting and great protection for the archers within. I noted the blinds' hose were in addition to the two miniature redoubts or turrets at either end of the dyke. I saw the wood and earth fortifications now boasted simple but effective canopies of tree limbs and sailcloth, not enough to keep out the cold, but enough to shed the rain. But that wasn't the best part. The best part was seeing what the boys had done with that empty shell of Hyre's tower in such a short time. Prompted by their own comfort, and eager to find favour with their master, the tower was now only second to my own residence when it came to comfort in Sevendor, I was amazed to see. The three-storied affair, with its mushroom-shaped roof, not only provided the height needed for proper observation and ranging well over the dyke, but a snug, dry and homey place for this lonely and potentially dangerous duty. Two native Sevendori peasant families had already erected crude huts nearby, the beginnings of the new hamlet that would arise in Brestall Farms, on the site of the abandoned manor closest to the gate, come spring. Tyndall told me they served the tower by providing firewood, bringing water from the well, cooking, and providing other support in exchange for a few silver pennies. All in all, I couldn't have asked for a better-kept watch, and said as much to Sir Tyndall over a hot mug of tea he poured for me in the guardroom. "You can thank Rondal for most of it," he grudgingly admitted. "I helped with a lot of the spell work, but honestly, most of the organization and design ideas came from him." "Still, you've made it both defensible and livable," I observed, "and under great hardship. That's commendable." He shrugged. Were his shoulders always that big? "We were bored," he said. "Do you know how interesting that yonder piece of West Flareia is? Less interesting than wondering about how interesting it is. Whatever your motivation, I'm pleased. I think that after the..." "Sire Minolin!" an excited voice from the watchtower called out. "Horsemen coming around the bend!" "Wains?" Tyndall asked the lookout before I could. "Nay," said Tyndall, "six horses, mounted for war, six armoured knights." Both Tyndall and I ran up the stairs in an instant, our hearts pounding. Armoured knights were rarely a good sign, and here I was unprepared for battle. I had a couple of small war wands I carried around by habit, but my weapons and such were back at the castle. Using mage sight from the peak of the tower, I could tell that calling them knights was a courtesy. There were six riders, but if any of them were over 20, I'm a poor observer. Indeed, the one in the center was not only armed and armored, but in full tilting armor that didn't seem to fit him properly. The others seemed about as old or younger. One couldn't have been more than 14, and the male hauberk he wore fell all the way to his calves. All of the boys were well bundled against the cold, and one bore a lance with a pennant on it.
"What is that thing on the banner? A chicken taking a shit?"
Tyndall asked, bemused. "That's a bird in a nest with an egg," I observed when the wind caught it enough to show. "A war bird, whatever fowl that is. That's the war bird of West Flaria, I'd guess. Sire Gimbal's badge. I'm guessing the egg represents his bastard son, Sir Ganyelan of Brestol. Shouldn't that be Sir Ganyelan formerly of Brestol?"
"Perhaps,"
I chuckled. "Let's go see what they want." They took a little longer to approach than I expected, perhaps because of the glow of the red mage light at the peak of the tower. It was a little intimidating if you didn't know what it was. It just hung there in the air and glowed, and didn't move a bit, no matter how hard the wind blew. It was disconcerting. They came within bowshot of the dike, but I'd ordered my men not to even knock a shaft. I didn't want to scare them off just yet. This might be entertaining. Sir Tyndall and I and four guardsmen awaited the knights at the threshold of the dike. Before the watch captain could approach them, the one bearing the pennant on his lance rested it, rode forward and shouted,
"Sir Ganyelan of Brestol approaches for parley."
His voice cracked.
"Let him come," called the guard captain, Vryn, gruffly. "He will not be harmed."
"I shall speak for him as his herald,"
the boy said. He didn't seem used to the sound of his own voice yet.
"I am Sir Subaral of Kest, ward of Sire Gimbal, the warbird of West Flaria," he proclaimed.
"Then speak, Sir Subaral of Kest," I called. "What is your errand?"
"Sir Ganyelan seeks to challenge the base-born rogue who stole from him his patrimony, the self-styled Mage Lord Minelan, to a duel to the death for possession of Brestol Vale. Sir Ganyelan has the courage to back up his rights with steel. Has Sire Minelan?"
he asked, a little too boldly for the occasion. It was more like a sandlot brag, not a serious challenge.
"What the hell's?"
Vryn asked.
"Did he just..." "Oh, this will be fun,"
Tyndall whispered. He closed his eyes for a moment, and I realized he was in psionic communication, no doubt with Rondal, back at the castle. So much for downplaying this later.
"He's challenging me,"
I sighed. "That toddler is really challenging me.
Ishi's tits."
"All right. What do I do?"
"I don't know,"
Tyndall shrugged. "Isn't he supposed to hit you in the face or something?"
"Maybe.
I've never fought a formal duel," I confessed. "I'm unsure about the protocol, particularly with children."
"Wooden swords until the first owie,"
quipped Vryn, wryly. "I think he's looking for more action than that," I observed.
"I don't think he could handle more action than that,"
Tyndall pointed out. I sighed. "Have Rondal dig up Sir Kay and ask him what the proper protocol is," I ordered quietly. "Vryn, ask him what cause Sir Ganyelan, and be sure you say Sir, not Sire, has to take such decisive action. Be respectful, and for Huin's sake, don't giggle. It's unbecoming an officer."
"I'll try, Min,"
he grunted. Most of the Bavali were still that informal with me, I was pleased to note.
"All right, Sir Subaral, what quarrel has Sir Ganyelan with the Mage Lord?"
he called loudly.
"He stole away the lands given to him by his father,"
Subaral replied.
"Whose father?"
Vryn demanded.
"Sir Ganyelan's father, the Lord of West Flaria."
"And he wants to see who?"
demanded Vryn, feigning confusion.
"Mage Lord Minelan,"
shouted Sir Subaral.
"And this is in reference to..."
Vryn said, playing dumb. He was terribly convincing.
"Sir Kay says that you are honour-bound as a knight to meet his challenge or forfeit the land,"
Tyndall whispered, while Vryn baffled the young knight. "He suggests that you ignore him. Unless there's a baron or above in rank present, no one is going to care if he made a challenge or you accepted it. He says it happens all the time."
"But I can't just ignore him,"
I whispered harshly.
"He came all this way." "What? You want to fight that kid?"
Tyndall asked me, snorting incredulously.
"Let me. I'll stomp his..."
"No, no. He's challenging me, or he thinks he is. It's a matter of honour or something.
It sounds like he wants to fight you over the possession of Brestol Vale. Can he do that?
Asked Vren. Well, I've heard of estates being gambled away over games of cards, dice and rushes. Sure, he can offer to fight me for it, but I don't have to accept.
But what if you do?
Tyndall asked.
You'll kill him,
and then you can say that you defended your claim to the territory with honourable combat, and the Westphalian claim goes away.
You think it would be that easy?
I don't. Now, I don't think the young Master Ganulan's sire or his uncle are aware that he's here. Every one of his retainers is as young as you, Tin. Looks like a couple of squires, a few men-at-arms. Probably everyone Ganulan could scrape up for this quest. And I doubt Gimble would accept me kicking the crap out of his son as an end to our reasonable claim to the land we stole back. In fact, it might just piss him off more, I pointed out. Especially if he had to shell out a lot of ransom, Tyndall observed. Damn, I hadn't thought about that. So how much do you think those chuckleheads are worth? I asked, reappraising the junior warriors in front of me for their market value, not their combat value.
I don't know, Tyndall shrugged. Who cares?
If we beat them up, we keep their armor and horses too, don't we? That's a nice little faro mare on the end there. Young, too. Tyndall was always as interested in horses as he was girls, a fetish I didn't understand. I wouldn't mind riding her about the valley, he said casually. Ask for the names and titles, I said to Vren, too low for the boys to hear it.
And which brave gentlemen are accompanying Sir Sibibold today? He asked sweetly. That's Sir Cerberol, shouted the boy angrily.
Ask Rondol to ask Sir Kay how much a young knight might be worth in ransom, I ordered Tyndall. Ask about squires, too, I added.
He says you can expect maybe 10 ounces of gold for a knight, plus the cost of his horse and armour, and 20 ounces of silver for a squire,
Tyndall replied a few moments later. But he cautions that those sorts of things are inexact and likely to fluctuate with local conditions.
So is my temper, I muttered to myself.
I turned back to the boys, and suddenly I saw them as walking, talking revenue streams. Their herald was nearing some sort of frustrated fit over Vren's dogged determination to misunderstand just who was who, and where they were from, and who their sires might be. They ended up being Sir Ganulan, his sworn sword brother Sir Cerberol, a ward of Gimble's, a 15-year-old Sir Festeran of Hosley, who had been knighted at Yule, and their 3 squires. Cerberol was by far the largest of them, but none of them had been blooded, to my eye. He was sputtering indignantly at Vren about the peasant's apparent stupidity and my moral shortcomings.
And I don't know if it is that you don't have the wits to be able to relay a simple message to the castle, or if it's the cowardice of the evil sorcerer who corrupts this veil, but enough,
I said loudly, and stepped forward. Vren stepped back deferentially. I didn't like that evil sorcerer talk.
And just who are you, Chal? Sneered the boy. This idiot's captain? Then perhaps you have the mind to...
No, I'm not this idiot's captain, I said, interrupting him. I'm this goodman's rightful lord.
What?
Sir Cerberol asked, confused. I am Sire Minolan the Spellmonger, Mage Lord of Sevendor, and Brestal Vale, I added, as it says on my ducal warrant, which I offered to present to your esteemed uncle.
Are you seriously challenging me? I asked. You lie, churl,
Sir Cerberol nearly shrieked, an unknightly sound.
Go now and fetch your master.
He put his hand threateningly on his sword. I cast back my woolen cloak. I was wearing my warmest tunic and under-tunic underneath, and didn't even bother to bring a mage blade. Who expects an attack right before a blizzard? But I never went far without a war wand, and today I'd grabbed 2.
I do not, I said quietly, and apart from Duke Rard, I owe no man as my master.
That took the young Jay back a step, and his horse actually stepped back, as if for dramatic effect. But his anger overcame his confusion quickly enough.
Prove it!
I shrugged, and then launched an impressive but harmless display spell, the kind you use to amuse the kids at Yule, which is why it was fresh in my mind and already hung. The young knights weren't amused, but they were impressed, and it took a few moments for them to calm their mounts.
I rather doubt they could calm their own hearts. Is that enough? I asked cheerfully. Or shall I turn you into a llama, Sir Severall?
What?
The boy asked, startled.
Fine. You are a mage,
he finally admitted. Mage Lord, I corrected.
It matters not. You have heard the challenge. Do you accept it, sir?
Well, this is my first duel over a matter of honour, I admitted. Can you tell me exactly how we proceed? Just what are the stakes?
Ownership of Brestall Vale and the satisfaction of Sir Ganyalan's honour, he demanded. The gods shall favour the righteous in a contest of justice.
The gods are notoriously unreliable in combat, I noted. But, as you say, it matters not.
Very well. And since you challenged, do I not have the right to set the terms and weapons, as well as the time and place?
That is your right, sir, the teenager admitted through clenched teeth.
At your convenience, Sir Ganyalan will be happy to provide satisfaction as long as the combat be honourable.
If the gods are on your side, how could it be honourable and fair? Tyndall pointed out with a snicker.
No doubt you have some hellish god of magic to call upon, the bully said with a derisive toss of his head. Let him do his worst.
Fair enough, I decided. I assumed that you are to act as Sir Ganyalan's second.
I have that honour, he replied gravely, all grown up.
Then let me introduce my second, my apprentice, Tyndall of Bovill Vale. Wave to the boys, Tyndall. Tyndall waved and grinned wolfishly. He'd worn his mage blade. He didn't go anywhere without it when he was on duty, mostly because the girls loved it. My old sword Slasher over his shoulder. Now, as far as the conditions, I will meet Sir Ganyalan on foot with whatever weapons each combatant chooses. I deem that the contest shall go to first blood, and I deem that before that fight happens, the rest of your party must engage my apprentice in honourable combat, one at a time, to first blood.
Cerberel didn't look pleased. We seek honourable combat, sir, not a general slaughter. I would not have it said that the noble warriors of West Flaria took advantage of a tradesman's apprentice and mistook it for a matter of honour.
You won't have to, Tyndall said, before I could stop him. I was knighted last autumn. I'm Sir Tyndall of Bovill Vale, Knight Mage, he said with too much satisfaction, and added a contemptuous bow. So if you think you can remove my head as first blood, then you may do so without fear of your precious honour enduring the stain, unless you fear to match yourselves against one older than you, he said, nodding towards the squires, who weren't looking quite so tough in their armour any more. And one born a commoner, he added. He enjoys goading the aristocracy as much as I do.
Then we shall satisfy your terms, the young hothead said savagely. Merely name the day and time and...
We're all already here, I pointed out. Now will do, if we make it quick. I have work to do. I wasn't just saying that either. I had planned to make it all the way to Brestall Tower before heading home before dark, but that looked like it was going to have to wait.
What?
Asked Sir Severall, alarmed.
Now?
You seem well arrayed for battle, I pointed out, and it seems silly for you to have made the trip without any blood to show on your swords. So let's go ahead and get this over with, I said, as Tyndall handed me his cloak and began warming up his muscles by stretching.
My lord, Severall said haughtily, it is customary to deal with such matters of honour in the eye of the world,
Severall informed me.
Say at the next tournament, or the Chepstow Spring Fair. To fight now would be unseemly.
To fight now would be convenient, and since that is what I have chosen, and since that idiot wanted to challenge me, I'm exercising my right to set terms. He can either accept them, or he can forfeit his challenge.
He accepts them, Severall said haughtily. The Warbird's own is a man of honour.
Tyndall snickered. Severall whirled.
You doubt his honour?
The baby knight demanded.
I doubt he's a man, Tyndall said, drawing Slasher without ceremony, and then cut the air decisively.
He enjoys swordplay and spent every moment he could practicing at it. Me, I study it because I have to, but I don't enjoy it. In 2 years, Tyndall will be a better swordsman than I.
Sabaral didn't dignify the remark with a response, but rode back to his fellows and began explaining the terms to them. I could see right away that they weren't thrilled with his negotiations. I glanced at Tyndall, and almost in unison we began magically eavesdropping on the boys as we had their betters.
"What do you mean we have to fight his apprentice?"
one of the squires said anxiously.
"You said we were coming along for show, to witness. You didn't say anything about fighting?"
"That's right," complained another one. "I only borrowed this sword. It's an antique. My uncle would kill—"
"Does that mean me too?"
asked the newest made knight, his voice shrill.
"Or just the squires? Because I think he meant just the squires, because it wouldn't do for a knight of my stature to do battle on the field of honour with a commoner."
"Well, the gods grant you fortune, then,"
Sabaral growled,
"because that peasant said he was made a knight last fall. So yes, it means you too, Sir Festering Cunt. But don't worry. Once the lads get through with him, I doubt there will be anything left for you."
"He's bloody tall,"
the shortest apprentice pointed out worriedly.
"He's a fucking up-jumped peasant,"
snarled Ganulin.
"You did right, Sir Sabaral. I want you to take him apart right in front of his master's eyes. Show them why the gods favoured us to be knights. As my sworn men, I command you to do this for me. I'll even grant an estate to the one who slays the boy."
"What bloody estate?"
the tallest squire asked incredulously.
"You don't have a fucking chamber pot of your own right now, do you? Your dad told you to let him handle it, but you had to go and make that oath before everyone at Yule that you'd be sitting in Brestall Tower on Brigger's Day or take holy orders. You're an idiot, Gan!"
"That's Sire Ganulin,"
the teenager screamed,
"and I command you to do as I bid. I swore that oath and I meant it. Besides, you cowards, it's only to first blood. If you are that much of a pussy, take a scratch and lose your armour and mount. But that's your choice. I'm going to stand up for my patrimony, and the gods shall see me triumph over this thieving bastard, whether you will or no."
"Your father is going to be angry again,"
Sir Festeran said so quietly I almost missed it.
"Really, he's going to... He might send you away to a temple somewhere, or disown you. Disinherit you, at least."
"Oh, shut up! This will be easy. He's a fucking mage. And you've seen how those guys look, all sickly and weak from reading books and such. My uncle's court mage in East Flaria can hardly make a candle light."
"What about those lights?"
the littlest squire complained.
"Those were real enough."
"Tricks,"
dismissed Cerberal.
"Did anyone get hurt?"
"If he was really as powerful as they say, then he would have killed us all then.
He didn't, because he can't. Besides, no mage can stand against a righteous sword. Remember the conquest!"
"Oh, this is going to be so much fun,"
whispered Tyndall eagerly. And it was, so much that I felt guilty about it later. A little. Tyndall was magnificent, playing the country bumpkin at first, mishandling his sword on purpose playfully, while avoiding the youngest squire's attempts to strike. The boy struggled to even move in his overlarge hauberk, much less defend himself, and in the end Tyndall took pity, tripped him, and pointed his sword at his throat.
"I yield! I yield!"
he squeaked. Tyndall nodded, helped him up, and sent him over to me. He was crying miserably, but otherwise unharmed. The second duel was over almost as quickly. The squire fought bravely, but stupidly, counting on heavy, broad swings of his sword to slice Tyndall in twain, while my apprentice danced around and parried when he felt like it. There are great advantages to wearing armour in war, less so in a duel. One great sweeping blow, delivered as if to split a log, buried his sword in the frozen ground, and Tyndall stepped on it, snapping the brittle metal in half. Then he kicked the boy in the face, sending him sprawling, his nose bloody.
"First blood," Wren called cheerfully. "Or here, boy, you belong to us now."
The third squire was better matched to Tyndall in size and even in speed, but once again my apprentice's skills were superior. At least this one gave him an actual fight, and took a slice across the forearm for his trouble. He joined his fellows, defeated and dejected. That's when Sir Festeran started to have second thoughts about his brand new armour, pretty new mare, and antique heirloom sword. He solemnly took sword and shield and stood at guard, and did nothing.
"Aren't you going to attack me?"
Tyndall asked, curious.
"Aren't you?"
Festeran challenged. The squires had all made aggressive attacks. The boy knight didn't want to commit himself. I could respect that. And because of his tactic, he forced Tyndall to work a bit. A mage blade against sword and shield is tough. The shieldman has an independent attack and defence, and that made it easy to bind a war mage's solitary blade. But Tyndall had practised against some outstanding shieldmen, the Orphans Band mercenaries at Timberwatch. He knew very well the dangers of getting too close to a shield. He also knew the shieldman's weakness, his blind spot. It took him nearly 5 minutes, but Tyndall finally managed to sail a cut from that blind spot up under Festeran's helmet, slicing open a gash about an inch long over his eyelid. The resulting wound bled horrifically, as all such scalp wounds do. Festeran fainted. The remaining two knights looked pale and disgusted. Sir Cerberal growled, "Are you now ready to face your challenger, Mage Lord?" he demanded. "My apprentice still has one blade uncrossed," I pointed out. "Your own."
"What?"
Cerberal repeated his favourite word.
"I am Sir Ganulan II. As such, it would be improper.
The agreement was for him to fight all the members of your party before Master Menelan kills Ganulan. Sorry, fights Ganulan,"
Wren corrected him with a sheepish grin.
Tyndall smiled. "I fancy that pretty armour of yours. So are you going to draw your blade, or do you forfeit?"
I could tell Cerberal hadn't considered fighting himself and didn't like the idea, but I could also tell that he was the sort whose honour wouldn't allow him not to undertake whatever boneheaded idea he desired. And now that he had a real duel in front of him, for his armour and mount, he couldn't very well back down.
"I stand ready,"
he said viciously, drawing his sword. It was a man-sized blade, a stout hand and a half-hilt he carried like a great sword. He made a few aggressive swipes in the air himself, and seemed much better with a blade than his fellows.
"You sure about this, Tin?" I murmured. "I fought goblins meaner than him," he reminded me, stretching his arms and back a little.
"Don't worry."
And I shouldn't have. I think he may have used a little magic here and there, but Tyndall took him apart. I knew he was toying with the other boys, but when he went up against Cerberal, I really got to see the result of all the sword work he'd practiced, and some of the war magic. Halfway through Cerberal's first strong attack, the strap on his left fambrace broke and entangled with the hilt of his greatsword. I suspected a cantrip, but I wasn't using mage sight, so I couldn't be sure. Cerberal recovered sloppily, but managed to stop three quick strikes at his head from Slasher. Then they settled into the traditional eyeball-to-eyeball circling contest that such fights often devolve into.
"You fight well for a mage,"
Cerberal admitted breathlessly, as he tried to repair his vambrace without dropping his guard, and ended up discarding it instead.
"You haven't seen me fight as a mage," Tyndall grinned. "I'm trying to go easy on you."
That just angered the young knight.
"Bring on your sorceries. I'm man enough to stand them."
"Idiot,"
I whispered to myself. Tyndall had just been waiting for a dramatic moment. Now he had it.
"Oh, right,"
my apprentice said, stretching his Wilderland accent into a caricature of ignorance. The next time he moved, it was with such blinding speed that I think I was the only one who saw what happened. The war magics used to accelerate reaction and improve speed and alacrity are powerful and terribly useful. It's one of the most basic edges a war mage has in straight combat. It was also one of the first pieces of war magic I had trained him in. Tyndall used it this time to rush his opponent and deliver a very shallow cut across his chin, and finished by tripping him as he tried to turn. Cerberal sprawled in the dirt, but was on his feet again with impressive speed.
"It will take more than that to—"
"Hey!" the knight said, as Tyndall dropped out of his guard.
"Why did you stop?"
"Because I won," Tyndall said matter-of-factly.
"First blood, remember?"
he pointed out, holding up Slasher's shiny blade to reveal a long, thin smear of blood decorating the edge. He used it to gesture to Cerberal's chin.
"I tagged you. That's blood. I've seen it before. I win."
I was treated to the sight of a strong, enthusiastic young man bound to the codes of chivalry and 4 centuries of warrior tradition throw an impressive snit when he realized that he had, indeed,
lost by the terms of the duel.
"That was not fair!"
he howled.
"I was not in guard, and—"
"First blood," I said firmly, "and I would not advise pushing the contest further, Sir Cerberal. You might feel bad now, but you'd feel worse if he blasted your heart out of your chest." That calmed him down a little. But now it was time for the main fight, the duel of honour over the possession of Brestall Vale between me and Ganulin. The youth still looked angry, but there was fear starting to creep into his eyes. "Hey, Tin, I left my sword back at the castle. Can I borrow yours?"
"Of course, sire,"
he said, calmly and graciously. "I went ahead and cleaned the blood off of it."
"You're so thoughtful,"
I smiled. I took the familiar blade, noting it needed a good sharpening, and immediately fell into the sword dance of the Magi. It sounds a lot more impressive than it is. It's just the first 8 forms of using a mage blade. They aren't that different than standard infantry slashing and poking, but there are subtleties of using a mage blade that the sword dance helps you realize. My first week at War College, before shipping off to Faris, involved us doing the sword dance over and over every morning until we could do it in our sleep. It's just 3 defensive postures, 3 strikes, and 2 positions that can be used for either. You practice it until it is done in a flowing, fluid movement. There are 2 other parts to the dance too, but I just did the first 8 forms a couple of times. And each time I increased my speed until I was doing it so fast, the sword was singing in the thin winter air. "I'm ready," I said when I folded myself back into first position. Ganulin's eyes were wide, and his pupils were tiny. "Remember," I said, as I confidently took my position, "the fight is to first blood. Removing your head constitutes first blood." I wasn't intending to kill him, just scare him. I was successful. His hands shook as he brought his sword into guard. "Would one of you gentlemen be so good as to call for us to start?" I asked.
"Begin!"
shouted the youngest squire, forgetting the ransom he now owed in his excitement. The moment he heard it, Ganulin sprang at me, swinging wildly. Oh, he showed a decent amount of training, and he didn't make any horrible mistakes. But that's a long way from being a competent swordsman. I let his swings slice the air, moving out of his way, keeping Slasher's tip moving in counterclockwise circles. He feinted left, and then tried a sweeping two-handed blow that would have beheaded me, had I not kicked the young knight in the knee and sent him sprawling. "Don't neglect your footwork," I instructed him. "You fight like you have bricks in your boots."
"I don't need lessons in swordplay from the likes of you,"
he snarled.
"Well, wherever you're getting them, you're being cheated," I said, blocking 2 quick but uninspired strikes in quick succession. "You keep throwing your elbows out too,"
I added when he made another pass.
"Damn it! Fight me like a man,"
he snarled, throwing sand at my head in an attempt to distract me. I stepped around it and blocked another desperate blow.
"You first," I quipped. "I'll carve out your heart,"
he shouted, and made another run. This time he tripped himself up, going down ass over elbows, his sword sliding from his hand. He scrambled to recover it and was back on his feet in moments.
"You couldn't carve a chicken properly. The way you handled that blade," I sneered. "If you want to carve out my heart, you have to strike me first."
That's how I spent the next 5 minutes, eluding Ganulin's blade and making snide comments about his fighting style. I actually won the duel by accident. He threw a 3-blow combination that seemed the limit of his sophisticated swordplay, and I responded with a half-hearted riposte that he failed to defend against. Quite to my surprise, Slasher's tip sliced the bottom sliver of Ganulin's left earlobe.
"Oh, sorry,"
I said involuntarily. "I don't mind sparring, but I don't want to injure anyone." Then I realized that this was a duel over property, and I'd just won.
"Damn you!"
howled Ganulin, looking at his own blood on his fingers.
"You cheated!"
"How can you cheat in a sword fight?" I asked. "Besides, you threw sand in my face first, and I didn't cheat. You didn't block. Big difference."
"I say you cheated,"
he declared.
his voice quivering. "And I say, this contest is over." I said, "You lost."
"I did not lose to a cheat," he demanded. "Admit you're wrong or..."
"Or what? You'll challenge me to a duel?" "You lost, Sir Ganulin. You are now technically my prisoner, and your armor and mount mine."
"I shall not give you my armor," he said nastily, "or my mount."
"But you lost," I pointed out. "First blood. Again. Doesn't it defend your honor that you are refusing to acknowledge your loss? Or are you the kind of knight who is only honorable when his betters are watching?"
"I'm the kind of knight that refuses to treat with cheaters."
"You have yet to tell me how I've cheated," I said, sheathing my sword.
"So, tell me, how did I?"
He didn't have an answer for that, so he sputtered and made more threats and promised to make me pay for my offences against him and called me a villain to boot. I let him spin down and then tried to get him to listen to reason. He wouldn't. In the end, I had to magically render him unconscious. Then I had the guards strip off his armor, and when he awoke, Tyndall escorted them all on foot down to Brestall Tower, where they would be kept until suitable ransoms could be arranged.
"That was fun,"
Tyndall sighed before we parted. I wanted to get back to the castle quickly. I glanced at the sky. No clouds yet, but I could feel the wind starting to pick up.
"So, how much do we ask for each of them?"
"Let me worry about that. But first, Sir Cerberol, do you acknowledge that you were bested according to the terms of the duel, and that your property is forfeit, that you are my lawful prisoner?"
"I do,"
he said haughtily. "My father will pay a suitable ransom for me, I swear." He made the sign of Duin the Destroyer to ask the war god to witness the oath.
"Good,"
I agreed. "If you swear, then I release you to return to Westphalia to raise it. There you can tell the war bird of your ill-fated trip against the mage lord and the disposition of your fellows."
But,
he said, suddenly looking more like a guilty teenager than a knight. "That's right. You get to explain to Sire Gimble just why his son is a prisoner, and five of his fellows. Then you get to explain whose brilliant idea the expedition was. And then I want you to tell your master this. I am not pleased with the temerity of this duel, as I have full legal right to Brestall Vale, and I resent having to take it back and defend it. I am so angry, in fact, that I promise that I will call down a savage blizzard to bury Westphalia as proof of my anger." The lad looked properly frightened, but his anger was still dominating his manner.
"Only the gods can tell the weather."
"Who says I don't know a few?" I sneered. "Just pass that along. I'm angry, and when you anger a mage lord, there are consequences. Now take your mount, and leave your armor and sword, and get the hells out of here." I turned back to Tyndall, purposefully dismissing Cerberal with my shoulder. "I want you to personally escort these prisoners back to Brestall Tower, and see that they are securely held and fed and housed according to their station, and make sure they get plenty of blankets. It's going to get cold tonight."